one employing the most advanced methods of production. But this rapid development had many negative consequences. With the shift of power from rural to urban areas, many of the former peasants found themselves worse off than before. Those who moved into the cities were exploited even more heavily in industrial work than they had been in agriculture. The Tsarist government was also unprepared for the movement of society toward liberalism and attempted to continue governing in an autocratic style. The combination of these factors made Russian society very unstable by the end of the 19th century. In this environment, Marxism seemed attractive to many as a way to improve the lives of the majority of Russians, since it criticized the social disruption and suffering that capitalism was creating, while also promising modernization and social equality. The problem was that traditional Marxism required a strong capitalist society to lay the groundwork for the emergence of communism from the proletariat. Autocracy, Marxists would agree, was a feudal rather than a bourgeois institution. Russian capitalism was still weak. Marxism thus might seem to require that its followers first strive for a capitalist Russia, a preposterous suggestion. One of the ways of overcoming this problem was to suggest that class consciousness should be brought to the workers by the intelligentsia. This was the proposal of Lenin and the Bolsheviks. Since Russia did not have a developed proletarian class, the party would be the vanguard of the proletariat, providing the necessary leadership and ideology to transform Russia into a communist nation. Lenin's contributions to Marxism were actually quite significant because, over time, they created a separation between the Communist Party, which promoted state ideology and ran a strong centralized government, and the working class, which was supposed to follow the direction of the party. In this way, Lenin, and Stalin after him, actually ended up emulating many features of the Tsarist model, setting up an autocratic party in place of the Tsar. This was not as great a shift as one might have expected. For example, even under Alexander's reforms, the state was already the primary investor in and funder of industrial projects, so a state-owned economy was not completely foreign to the Russian people. The government was the largest single employer, directing a huge bureaucracy and commanding the involuntary service of many of its subjects, including state serfs. Even those areas of the economy left to private operation were expected to gear their activities to the state's military and economic needs. Thus, under Tsarism, the state grew at the expense of its citizens, establishing a pattern of absolutism upon which the communists were later to build. Russian Marxism also retained some key characteristics of Orthodox Christianity. For one, Orthodox Christianity was a much more communal religion than its Western counterpart. The religious person was thought of first as a member of the congregation, and individual religious experience was de-emphasized. Orthodoxy also tended to support the absolute authority of the national ruler, unlike Roman Catholicism, which looked to the Pope as the absolute leader of society. Despite its Marxist roots, the communist society erected by the Bolsheviks must be understood as deriving in part from a Russian tradition that was fundamentally at variance with Western values and habits. Soviet society parallels so many of the traditional Russian modes that the influence of the latter appears to be significant. The introduction of Marxism into Russia resulted in a transformed Marxism. To be sure, the impulse for Russian Marxism was still the liberation of workers from exploitation, but the method of implementation was deeply Russian. Unfortunately, because Lenin and other leaders assumed that they were bringing a predetermined, universal Marxism to the people, it was not possible for them to see that many of the cultural resources they needed were already present within Russian society. Had they thought of Marxism in a postmodern way, perhaps they could have seen that the rural peasants had much to offer the movement. Of course, not everything about Russian culture would have been desirable as the nation moved forward, such as the tendency to absolutism, but it would have made a great difference if Marxist leaders would have used their energies to connect Marxism with those cultural values that did support a society geared toward the common good, including the Russian emphasis on communalism over individualism. Had communist leaders recognized the way that Russian Marxism was building upon existing cultural and religious patterns, they might have been able to avoid the separation between party and proletariat that led to many abuses of the poor and to dissatisfaction on the part of many citizens. Marxism in China. Mao Zedong thought. The Chinese context produced an even more complicated revision of Marx's view of history. In the first place, Marx himself defined Asiatic societies differently at different points in his work. In the Grundrisse, Marx argued that Asiatic societies were characterized by villages where land was owned communally, with the state exercising purely formal ownership. He believed that these communities were not necessarily organized in a feudal system, but in Das Kapital, Marx returned to the more common European view of his time, in which the Asiatic mode of producing was said to depend on imperial ownership of land. Here, Marx assumed that Chinese society required a despotic government in order to construct and maintain the extensive hydraulic works for agriculture. He believed that this fact necessarily prevented any private ownership of land in China, placing the country again in the category of a feudal society. Since the Grundrisse remained unpublished for many years after Marx's death, it was Marx's views in Das Kapital that were available to early Chinese Marxists. Many Chinese scholars believe that Marx's idea of Chinese history, especially in Das Kapital, was Eurocentric and overly simplistic. In reality, China has always had a dynamic history, which has included vast changes in its economy and social structures over time. For much of its history, Chinese agriculture was actually characterized by a mixture of private and state ownership, even in those empires that undertook large public works. For example, irrigation was often made possible by investments from large landowners rather than the state itself. Certainly, China could not be called feudal in the same sense as Western Europe in the Middle Ages. Not since the Tang and Northern Wei dynasties had Chinese society consisted of patrimonial fiefdoms in which serfs were tied to the land, obtaining protection in exchange for service on the lord's estate. Even then, the bulk of the economy was outside the estate system. Likewise, over the centuries, Chinese economy had developed in ways that did not fit the European model of history that Marx knew from his own context, although it did include a significant inequality between the rural peasants and the mostly urban gentry and landlords. As in Russia, Marxism was attractive to many Chinese people in the early 20th century because it promised an alternative to the inequality of capitalist systems, as well as a constructive route towards the future. China had suffered for many years under the exploitation of English and Japanese imperialism, and needed to find a way to strengthen the nation. At the same time, the inequalities of the past social order were unacceptable to the majority of the people, who were rural farmers. As Mao Zedong wrote, "The ruthless economic exploitation and political oppression of the peasants by the landlord class forced them into numerous uprisings against its rule. It was the class struggles of the peasants, the peasant uprisings, and the peasant wars that constituted the real motive force of historical development in Chinese feudal society." Mao and others adapted Marxism to their particular context by making rural areas the center of the Marxist movement in China instead of relying on an urban proletariat. The serious problem is the education of the peasantry. The peasant economy is scattered, and the socialization of agriculture, judging by the Soviet Union's experience, will require a long time and painstaking work. Without socialization of agriculture, there can be no complete consolidated socialism. As in Russia, the Chinese cultural context affected the way that Marxism was applied. In particular, Confucian morality had a great effect on Mao's thought, even as he rejected its role in maintaining the oppressive social structures of the past. Confucianism has always emphasized the need for leaders of the country to be virtuous, censuring those who do not measure up to its standard. Each individual must conform to a demanding code of conduct in order to be able to act according to the Confucian ideal. Although Mao was critical of many elements of Confucianism, he maintained these forms of thought in his adaptation of Marxism. Like Confucianism before it, Maoism teaches a commitment to transforming the world by applying the lessons of a utopian ideology to the actions and institutions of everyday life. This is not to claim that Mao was a closet Confucian, but to emphasize that the Confucian way was virtually synonymous with the Chinese way. Both Confucianism and Maoism are uniquely Chinese. Confucian patterns of thought have remained very important to Chinese society, even during times when leaders have sought to cut all ties with previous cultural values. Chinese Marxism today. China today is facing new challenges that require new adaptations of Marxism. The context is very different from Germany in the 1840s, when Marx began fighting back against the controlling capitalist powers. China's economy has become far more complex than it was in the past, especially in light of the one country, two systems policy of Deng Xiaoping. At the same time, Chinese leaders are seeking to find a pragmatic balance between the core principles of both Marxism and Confucianism, which call for a virtuous state and a virtuous people. Leaders are seeking to find creative extensions of core Marxist principles in order to provide guidance through these new economic and social realities. One of the new crises that postmodern Chinese Marxism is now confronting is the injustice that humans have wrought on the environment. Just as traditional Marxism sides with the workers in the face of exploitation by the capitalists, so the new Marxism must act to prevent the exploitation of nature on the part of those who seek to maximize short-term profits and GDP. This raises questions about the value and agency of nature, to which we return in Chapter 11. Today, the global context is characterized by ever greater inequities between rich and poor, limits on economic growth imposed by the depletion of resources, and a disruption of the planet's climate patterns that is now affecting ecosystems and their inhabitants, both human and non-human, around the world. As grave as it is, this crisis also provides humans with a unique opportunity to implement Marxist principles for the common good, utilizing positive resources from the past while firmly renouncing those aspects of each culture that have created oppressive relationships between persons and nations. In the past, Marxism has shown itself capable of adapting to the cultural forms of each new situation and context. Although the first process of cultural adaptation began as soon as Marxism began traveling eastward from Germany into Russia, today's global context calls for even more complex and radical adaptations. In particular, the relationship between Marxist thought and cultural values needs to be conceived in a genuinely dialectical fashion. Under the influence of Hegel, Marx conceived dialectic as a synthesis of thesis and antithesis, in which differences are transcended yet preserved, aufgehoben. Traditional Chinese thought, influenced by Taoist thought, describes the process of establishing or re-establishing the harmony between complementary principles. When Western and Eastern notions of dialectics can be harmonized, a stronger political philosophy results. What has not worked is the construction of a Marxism free of all cultural influences. Claims to have invented a purely universal political philosophy usually hide the influences of the author's particular time and place. However much one denies them, history and culture persist in often unconscious ways. Attempts to eliminate the past, as in Lenin's creation of a party-centered communism, or the excesses of Mao's cultural revolution, often cause it to manifest in particularly destructive ways. By contrast, Marx's original vision to create a more just and equitable society actually requires cultural resources and a constructive retrieval of the past. Chapter 6. Deconstructive Postmodernism and Critical Marxism. How do contemporary Western interpretations of Marxism address the realities of the history we have just considered? In this chapter, we look at two well-known Western movements that have written positively about the legacy of Karl Marx: Deconstructive Postmodernism and Critical Marxism. We focus in on three of the most influential representatives of these movements: Jacques Derrida, Slavoj Žižek, and David Harvey. These authors provide creative, even startling interpretations of Marx and Marxism. What remains less clear, however, is to what extent they offer practical guidance in addressing urgent global issues. Can policymakers find constructive guidance here as they seek to adapt Marx to the very different demands of the 21st century? Jacques Derrida. In the West, postmodernity is often linked to the work of one philosopher, Jacques Derrida. His method of deconstruction has become one of the best-known alternatives to modern thought. Deconstruction is a way of challenging the hierarchies of concepts that have characterized Western thought since Plato, but have been more pronounced since the advent of modernity. Deconstruction includes both a reversal of this hierarchy of concepts and a recognition that competing concepts somehow include each other. Derrida writes, "Therefore we must proceed using a double gesture, according to a unity that is both systematic and in and of itself divided, a double writing, that is, a writing that is in and of itself multiple. On the one hand, we must traverse a phase of overturning. To do justice to this necessity is to recognize that in a classical philosophical opposition we are not dealing with the peaceful coexistence of a vis-a-vis, but rather with a violent hierarchy. One of the two terms governs the other, axiologically, logically, etc., or has the upper hand. To deconstruct the opposition, first of all, is to overturn the hierarchy at any given moment. To overlook this phase of overturning is to forget the conflictual and subordinating structure of opposition. Therefore, one might proceed too quickly to a neutralization that, in practice, would leave the previous field untouched, leaving one no hold on the previous opposition, thereby preventing any means of intervening in the field effectively." The classic example that Derrida uses is the binary opposition between speech and writing in Western philosophy. Many philosophers have assumed that speech and writing constitute different forms of language, and that speech is the more authentic form. But Derrida points out that there are no characteristics of speech that cannot also be attributed to writing. In particular, both speech and writing can be said to be derivative of other sign systems. This means that neither speech nor writing can be called the natural way of expressing oneself. In fact, Derrida argues that writing could be said to be the basis for speech instead of the other way around. Now, from the moment that one considers the totality of determined signs, spoken and a fortiori written, as unmotivated institutions, one must exclude any relationship of natural subordination, any natural hierarchy among signifiers or orders of signifiers. If writing signifies inscription, and especially the durable institution of a sign, and that is the only irreducible kernel of the concept of writing, writing in general covers the entire field of linguistic signs. In that field, a certain sort of instituted signifiers may then appear, graphic in the narrow and derivative sense of the word, ordered by a certain relationship with other instituted, hence written, even if they are phonic, signifiers. The very idea of institution, hence of the arbitrariness of the sign, is unthinkable before the possibility of writing and outside of its horizon. In Derrida's sustained reflection on Marxism at a conference in 1991, now published as Spectres of Marx, he links his own project of deconstruction with certain tendencies in Marx and Engels' original vision of communism. This famous conference took place only a few years after the fall of the Berlin Wall, 1989, when many Western scholars were ready to declare the end of Marxism and the triumph of capitalism. According to Derrida, Marxism is relevant now more than ever because the disintegration of the concrete structures of communism allow for Marx's original criticisms of capitalism to haunt us. He says, "When the dogma machine and the Marxist ideological apparatuses, states, parties, cells, unions, and other places of doctrinal production, are in the process of disappearing, we no longer have any excuse, only alibis, for turning away from this responsibility." Derrida believes that the triumph of capitalism in the West has only served to highlight its own failures, as human suffering continues and environmental catastrophe appears inevitable. Western economic systems have only exacerbated the plagues of underemployment, foreign debt, arms trade, and interethnic violence. For Derrida, Marxism is still relevant not because it represents a possible political program that could be implemented. Instead, it provides us with a set of important ideals that are clearly far from being realized, and indeed are impossible to realize, under the system of global capitalism. It acts as a specter that continues to make us dissatisfied with the shortcomings of our current reality. Marxism becomes a deconstructive principle. It never arrives in order to be put into practice, but remains relevant only in the sense that it prompts us to ask critical questions about systems and practices that are now in place. "It can never be always present," Derrida writes. "It can be only, if there is any, it can be only possible. It must even remain a can be or maybe in order to remain a demand." Here, Marxism is able to serve as a critique of the current world order precisely because it is now no longer a real option for providing such order itself as a positive, constructive philosophy. Derrida's analysis creates a deconstructive space for political theory, and for Marxist theory in particular. This space is characterized by the assumption that Marxism, or any other particular school of thought, is best used as critical theory rather than a set of practical policies. Partly because of the past abuses of communist leaders like Stalin and the imperialism of the West, Derrida and other Western deconstructive philosophers seem to have lost faith in the possibility that a philosophy could actually help to implement a sustainable, harmonious society. Slavoj Žižek. Slavoj Žižek, although he is critical of Derrida's version of deconstruction, lives in this space that deconstruction has created in the West. Žižek is a senior researcher and cultural critic at the University of Ljubljana, Slovenia. His influences include Jacques Lacan and psychoanalysis, Marxism, Hegel and German idealism, and the Frankfurt School of Philosophy. He studied at Ljubljana and the University of Paris, returning to Ljubljana in 1971 as a researcher. For a time, he was an active member of the Communist Party of Slovenia, and then was involved with the Committee for the Defense of Human Rights. Žižek's controversial theories and confrontational style have made him one of the most visible Western philosophers of our time. In his book, In Defense of Lost Causes, Žižek outlines his suggestions for a new version of Marxism that could help us respond to the looming environmental crisis. He agrees that traditional Marxism has identified the main problems with global capitalism that are leading us toward this crisis. Every citizen is pressured to consume as much as possible. No one feels personally responsible for the consequences of the circulation of capital or the depletion of natural resources. And because the market is the product of a huge number of interactions between individuals, each individual feels as though he or she is powerless to change the system. But Žižek does not believe that traditional Marxism is an adequate philosophy either. Instead, he claims that traditional Marxism does not go far enough to deconstruct the way that we think about humanity, history, and ecology. Unfortunately, the proposal that Žižek puts forward in its place is, like Derrida's, more deconstructive than practical. In his adaptation of traditional Marxism to the current social and political situation, Žižek deconstructs the concept of humanity, history, and nature. First, he identifies a new possible global proletariat made up of people excluded from the state economies and administrations. Given the current state of affairs, Žižek believes that the biggest factor that determines the quality of a person's life is not the difference between owner and laborer, but between those who are formally included in the economy and those who are excluded or informally connected. The excluded are found primarily in the urban slums that exist worldwide outside most big cities. Here, they receive no benefits from the state, there is no law or infrastructure, no insurance, etc. They may be integrated into the economy informally, as day laborers or self-employed entrepreneurs, but they are not recognized as workers by the state. According to Žižek, if the principal task of the emancipatory politics of the 19th century was to break the monopoly of the bourgeois liberals by politicizing the working class, the principal task of the 21st century is to politicize, organize, and discipline the destructured masses of slum dwellers. This means, however, that in Žižek's proposal, the state is always going to be part of the problem, not the main agent of transformation. Next, Žižek deconstructs the concept of history. Traditional Marxism expects the working class to perform a political act that will bring about a more just economic order. Žižek says this foundational aspect of Marxism depends on a linear, historical view of time, in which, he says, at each moment of time, there are multiple possibilities waiting to be realized. Once one of them actualizes itself, others are canceled. In this view of history, the goal is to look at the various possibilities that may occur in the future and choose the one that appears to lead toward the best outcome. The problem, Žižek claims, is that the rise of global capitalism appears to be inevitable, leaving individuals and nations with no choice but to adapt or to be left behind. This hopelessness can lead people to believe that there is nothing that they can do to prevent the environmental crisis that comes along with capitalism. In response, Žižek suggests that we view history as circular. It is possible, he suggests, that our actions retroactively change past possibilities, that they introduce something radically new into history, that they break free of the set of possible actions that we are led to believe in from past experiences. In this case, he says, we should first perceive environmental catastrophe as our fate, as unavoidable, and then, projecting ourselves onto it, adopting its standpoint, we should retroactively insert into its past, the past of the future, counterfactual possibilities. If we had done this and that, the catastrophe we are now in would not have occurred, upon which we then act today. Extending this idea even further, Žižek also suggests that we deconstruct our ideas of ecology or nature. On his view, one of the greatest obstacles to significant political change is the environmental movement itself. One of the myths of environmentalism, he claims, is that of the natural world that exists in a harmonious balance until humans arrive and destroy this balance. Žižek believes that what we call nature is actually nothing more than a series of catastrophes, arbitrary changes of direction that include great loss of life. Human behavior is simply an extension of this natural imbalance, though admittedly one that threatens to be more destructive than any past event in the Earth's history. Žižek suggests, therefore, that we come to terms with two facts. First, that there is no such thing as nature independent of human influence. And second, that our actions can permanently disturb the ordinary state of our world. As a result, We should try to influence our environment in such a way that we avoid catastrophe, not by returning to an original state of balance, but by making collective, radical political choices to change our patterns of consumption. Zizek's method allows him to make some brilliant observations about the assumptions that underlie both capitalism and traditional Marxism. It allows him to gesture towards a possibility of political change, which includes more specific recommendations than would be possible with Derridean deconstruction. Zizek suggests that radical political change should occur through a mobilization of those excluded from the apparatus of the state. It should institute severe but egalitarian measures that limit consumption and pollution, and it may use violence, even terror, to accomplish these things. At the same time, the radical nature of Zizek's proposal means that it functions more as a theoretical critique of existing systems than a real possibility for action. The ideal political response for Zizek would be one that breaks completely from the usual idea of what is possible or even desirable. But because nearly all political action contains elements of the past and builds on common social wisdom, he ends up dismissing any actual political program in favor of an abstract, idealized radical program. Zizek's political action is therefore always deferred action, not action that can be put into practice in our existing context. David Harvey. Another current interpretation of Marxism claiming to offer an alternative to global capitalism is that of David Harvey. Harvey, who teaches at the Graduate Center at City University of New York, has been extremely influential in his own field of human geography, as well as in the humanities more generally. His book, Social Justice and the City, 1973, was one of the first to suggest that the field of geography should not remain objective in the face of economic inequality. With books such as Limits to Capital, 1982, and The New Imperialism, 2003, Harvey has become an outspoken critic of unregulated capitalism. Harvey was listed in 2007 as one of the top 20 most cited authors in the humanities and social sciences. In some ways, Harvey's use of Marx is diametrically opposed to that of Zizek. He pursues a systematic scientific critique of capitalism, as opposed to the anti-systematic Zizek. As much as Harvey criticizes the postmodern lack of meta-narrative and its deconstructive tendencies, however, his own proposal also fails to provide a real alternative vision, especially for non-Western contexts. Harvey's work offers excellent explanations of the way that capitalism functions, but it remains too general to be able to make concrete suggestions about how to utilize the cultural differences that inevitably play a role in political systems. Harvey's project is nicely summarized in his famous text. There are laws of process at work under capitalism capable of generating a seemingly infinite range of outcomes out of the slightest variation in initial conditions or of human activity and imagination. In the same way that laws of fluid dynamics are invariant in every river of the world, so the laws of capital circulation are consistent from one supermarket to another, from one commodity production system to another. Harvey attempts to uncover these laws and expose the violence that allows capitalism to continue. According to his influential critique, the major problem of capitalism is that wealth tends to accumulate faster than it can be put to use. This overaccumulation manifests itself both as unused capital and unused labor, underemployment or unemployment. In the resulting scenario, excess capital and excess labor exist side by side with no way of being brought back together. In order to restore a stable rate of profit, some capital must be eliminated. These crises can be solved in various ways: by creating fictitious capital or credit, by exporting capital to other locations, or by expanding the circulation of products and capital to new markets. The effect of the latter two alternatives is to push the devaluation of capital or labor onto different geographical locations, generally developing nations, rather than to suffer the effects of devaluation in the original location, generally the developed nations. When the potential devaluation is severe enough, conflicts arise as to who is going to bear the burden of this devaluation. As Harvey writes, trade wars, dumping, interest rate wars, restrictions on capital flow and foreign exchange, immigration policies, colonial conquest, the subjugation and domination of tributary economies, the forced reorganization of the division of labor within economic empires, and finally, the physical destruction and forced devaluation of a rival's capital through war are some of the methods at hand. Harvey believes that these violent actions are an inevitable part of capitalism. In the end, he argues, capitalism can only be sustained by expanding violent conflict, which will eventually involve the entire world in immense destruction. David Harvey's work focuses on a close analysis of Marx's original writings, especially Das Kapital, and therefore tends to neglect the important variants among Marx-inspired systems of government around the world, each one responding in unique ways to the historical, social, and economic situation that they face. If anything, Harvey goes to the opposite extreme. At times, he dismisses specific Marxist movements as being militantly particular. He writes negatively about the socio-cultural location of particular political movements, which keeps them from achieving sufficient critical distance and detachment to formulate global ambitions. As Alex Kayinikos writes in his important critique of Harvey's work, Harvey is an intellectual based in the academy, participating in and reflecting on social movements that develop outside it and that usually lack, as the phrase militant particularism implies, the comprehensive program possession of which is surely one defining characteristic of a party. Writing at a fairly abstract level allows Harvey to take a wide view of the problems of capitalism and to make general criticisms that apply to global economic systems. At the same time, this approach leaves Harvey less flexible in addressing the specific contexts in which economic policies are always instantiated. This means that his work is mainly useful as a critical commentary on global capitalism. As effective as it is for this purpose, it lacks a specific platform that could be used to construct new paths beyond the capitalist system. Worse, in a sort of antithesis to real politic, Harvey explicitly criticizes attempts to achieve an organic integration of Marxist principles with the ethos of specific civilizations and histories, such as the Chinese people. In contrast to this view, we argue that each national history, each specific context of a developing nation, is like the particular soil within a particular ecosystem. The wise farmer, knowing his soil, will select the appropriate seeds, plant them in the appropriate density, and cultivate them for maximal growth and sustainability. Derek Gregory asks, if the world doesn't come as clean as you can think it, as A.N. Whitehead almost said, and Harvey holds his work in high regard, too, and if in consequence we need to recognize and respect the diversity and variability of life on Earth, what worlds are lost in Harvey's explorations? If one takes Harvey as his sole guide, one would certainly lose the world of cultural particularity, the resources that make each nation and people different from one another. In a certain sense, Harvey's theory works in the same way that imperialist capitalism does. It maintains its own value by expanding its reach to cover more and more of the globe. More importantly, since this theory does not take account of the differing cultural features within different contexts, it will be more difficult to implement his suggestions. As we saw in Chapter 3, theories must always be adaptable to new contexts in order to be practicable. Conclusion. Derrida, Zizek, and Harvey represent three of the most well-known Western interpreters of Marxism of the last few decades. The first two embed Marxism in the context of European postmodernism in order to encourage radical political imagination, whereas Harvey uses it scientifically to uncover the underlying structure of capitalism. We have found reason to worry that these approaches do not produce a constructive version of Marxism that is able to both build upon the past and to create new ways forward into the future. The work of Derrida and Zizek focuses on the idealized possibility of radical change in ways that obscure the potential of existing political structures and social wisdom. Harvey's analysis remains at a generalized or global level, which keeps him from constructing concrete, practical programs for improving particular socioeconomic systems. We have purposefully combined these sharply contrasting thinkers into a single chapter. Each one has been highly influential in the Western discussion, and each one has generated much attention and commentary. The first two represent the movements of deconstruction and post-structuralist thought, two movements that tend to be anti-scientific, or at least openly suspicious of scientific claims to knowledge. Harvey, by contrast, claims to utilize a scientific approach and to draw deeply from the resources of social scientific study. As later chapters will show, much of the Western discussion has been imprisoned within one or the other of these two approaches. The scientific approaches limit themselves to stringent empirical standards and to a relatively small set of methods, thereby losing insights that can be achieved through cultural and historical studies. The deconstructive approach can easily become anti-rational and anti-scientific, since science also becomes one of the targets of their deconstructive method. Ironically, both groups pull back from the concrete examples and situations that are the daily bread of policymakers in local, provincial, and national governments. How will Marxist ideals be useful to the art of government if they become limited by definition to the purely abstract and scientific on the one side, and the purely ideal or deconstructive on the other? Once again, it appears, the Western thinkers succeed at formulating the extreme possibilities, the excesses on both sides, while failing to find the blended position that would represent a balance between them. They express the dissonance of the present global situation, but shy away from addressing the practical issues that policymakers face. How can one govern wisely if the tool in one's hand is a disharmonious Marxism? All agree on the urgency of the task. Unrestrained capitalism is like a speeding car heading toward a wall, out of control, where the driver should be hitting the brake, he instead pushes harder on the accelerator pedal. And many agree that Marxist principles can, in principle, help to guide us through this crisis, but many of the Western theorists seem unable to formulate the updated version of Marxism that leaders need. Only a balanced framework can guide policymakers to wise decisions in the concrete decision-making situations that they face. Chapter 7. Rethinking Freedom and Human Rights After Liberalism. Most Americans have been taught that freedom, human rights, democracy, and justice exist only in the liberal tradition, the tradition of John Locke and his followers. To be a socialist or a Marxist, we are told, is to give up all four. We call this the great myth of liberalism. Probably no statement in political philosophy is more filled with untrue and half-true assumptions. Why would one think that the freedom of John Locke and his modern liberal successors is the only kind of freedom? Such a claim suppresses so much of the history of political theory and ignores so much counter-evidence that one is tempted to ask, whose interests are served by this teaching? Who stands to gain from propagating this myth? Although that question is worth pursuing, we will not pause to explore it here. It's more important to trace the roots of the myth of liberalism, to lay bare its hidden assumptions, and then to formulate a better alternative. Why would the myth seem so compelling to Americans? In part, it's because, from the very beginning, American children are socialized to believe the story of American exceptionalism. Unique among the nations of the earth, we are the land of the free and the brave. We are the world's oldest democracy, and thus, the story says, we are the best one, perhaps the only true democracy. Only our justice system is really just, and only our form of government really preserves human rights. Our teachers and textbooks then add anecdotes about cases in other countries where freedom and justice are absent. Whether explicitly or implicitly, American children are taught how exceptional and unique they are. The vast majority of Americans continue to believe the story of political liberalism, which locates them in the lineage of John Locke. The story comes in two very different forms, however. The conservative version of the story seeks to conserve some set of traditional moral and ethical values that, it says, should guide society, and it advocates for the least possible interference from the government. This is the libertarian version of the John Locke story. The progressive or liberal version consigns such moral and religious values to the private realm, advocating instead for a larger government role in providing welfare and social services for those who need them. Conservatives will be the most hostile to organic Marxism. By contrast, liberals sometimes have difficulty seeing how their view is different from it. We support social democracy, welfare protections, social services, and national health care. Liberal is just our way of saying that we disagree with the conservatives. Aren't liberals already halfway to socialism? This view, though widespread, rests on a mistaken assumption. The liberal version of the John Locke story still carries the DNA of its forefathers, John Locke and Adam Smith. Thus, it remains, at base, a capitalist solution. Lin Trin writes, "The welfare state has not actually solved problems of poverty and inequity, most significantly manifested in the distribution of wealth and power, and nothing in its policies could be seen as specifically socialist. As Dorothy Wedderburn remarked, the effect of, or the values embodied in, welfare legislation represented no more than an unstable compromise between the market and laissez-faire on the one hand, and planned egalitarianism on the other. Indeed, Western social democracies stand far closer to liberalism than most liberals realize. Why? On paper, capitalist democracies provide liberty and justice for all, as American school children repeat every morning when they salute the flag. But in practice, liberty and justice are available to different degrees depending on wealth and skin color and other factors. Marx wanted to extend these benefits to the working class and the most disenfranchised in society. In his early work, for example, he spoke of the ideal society as a true democracy. He later called it communism, to express the goal of genuine community for all. For Marx, a socialist society will not be opposed to the values of freedom, rights, and democracy, but will be the fulfillment of these values. In this and the following chapter, we will see that terms like freedom and justice are the focus of heated debate between two competing schools of thought. It's crucial to understand the radically different approaches that are taken toward these terms so that one can see what is at stake in each case. The dispute is not, as one says, merely academic. We will find that significant differences in practice result, depending on whether one accepts the one perspective or the other. Freedom. The idea of freedom is one of the most emotionally charged ideas in human culture. Whatever the actual limitations and constraints on us, we experience ourselves as free, able to do what we want, able to change our mind, able to decide freely between multiple options. Perhaps nothing brings more fear than the thought of being held in chains, unable to walk or move our limbs. This fundamental biological drive for freedom of motion, evident in the youngest children, fuels the deeply emotional discussions about freedom in political theory. Studying the charged debates about freedom over the last four centuries, one quickly discovers that at least two radically different notions of freedom are at work. Put in its most simple form, it concerns the distinction between freedom from and freedom for. One group of theories emphasizes being free from constraint, or outside interference, and thus free to do what one wishes. The other group focuses on the freedom to be able to pursue and achieve goods, better social conditions, better education, more just distribution of resources, higher overall quality of life. Hearing this distinction, one immediately recognizes that freedom from and freedom for do not need to be in competition. Tragically, however, both sides of the political debate have tended to focus on one at the expense of the other. Freedom from constraint. In Chapter 2, we traced the influence of John Locke on the origins of the American political system. Following in the tradition of Hobbes and Locke, the American founding fathers believed that the role of government should be minimal. Governments should protect citizens against loss of life, loss of liberty, and loss of property. Here, liberty, freedom, is meant in the narrower sense of constraints on one's freedom of movement and basic freedoms of choice. A similar understanding of freedom as freedom from constraint underlies the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or of the right of the people peaceably to assemble, and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. The fundamental emphasis here is to block or constrain government interference on citizens' behavior. Each citizen should be able to say what he wants, publish what he wants, meet publicly with others when he wants, and petition the government about whatever are his concerns. The first three became known as the rights to freedom of speech, press, and assembly. We will see in the next section that the language of rights has also become divided between positive and negative rights. Each item in the First Amendment implies a freedom from limitation. For example, freedom of speech means the freedom to express oneself without interference or constraint by the government. The so-called Establishment Clause, prohibiting the government from establishing a religion, creates a separation between the state and the various religious groups that exist within the country. This means that the government should stay out of the way when religious people pray in their own home or meet in their religious building. The image is that a religion is self-contained and private. All it needs to thrive is that the government not get in the way. Americans soon learned, however, that things were not this simple. The history of Supreme Court interpretations of the First Amendment shows a constant struggle to find compromises between freedom from and freedom for. For example, a given member of the Jehovah's Witnesses religion wants freedom from interference, but the government decides that he cannot refuse to authorize a blood transfusion for his child, and thereby cause his child to die. The white supremacists who want the freedom to march through the streets of their city cannot create a hate-filled environment that compromises the quality of life of African Americans who also live in that city. Recent lawmakers in the state of Arizona wished to pass a law that would allow business owners to use their religious beliefs as a legal justification to refuse to serve same-sex couples. For example, the restaurant owner could say that a homosexual couple could not eat in his restaurant merely because they are gay. One advocate of this law told the press, "Faith shouldn't be something we have to leave inside our house." He wishes to extend the freedom from constraints on his private exercise of religion into a freedom from constraints on how he treats other citizens when he is operating his business. Imagine, however, that a business provides medical care, or basic social services, or education. Imagine that enough citizens in a city make use of such a law so that basic health services become unavailable to homosexual couples and their families, or to people with black skin, or to Jews. As Daniel Mock of the American Civil Liberties Union responded, "Religious freedom is a fundamental right, but it's not a blank check to harm others or impose our faith on our neighbors." Freedom understood exclusively as freedom from any constraints on what I want to do with my money has become a major contributor to the global climate crisis. expressed through the spending habits of wealthy individuals, the unrestrained business practices of multinational corporations, and the lax policies of governments? This mindset has led to abuses of the environment that are now spinning out of control at the global level. The same mindset has created huge injustices across the planet, since poverty, starvation, and pollution in developing nations are byproducts of rich people and governments in developed nations exclusively pursuing their own interests. We need to understand how the two sides of human freedom, which ideally should work